visibility of the other's missions for operational security purposes.
Did Reese make any arrangements with him relative to Nawaz? Rodriguez interjected.
No, sir. There was an unforeseen twist in Muhammad's story. He claims to have been directed to carry out these attacks by a former agency contractor named Jules Landry, who has been running Muhammad under the auspices of a legitimate CIA operation. Landry has been missing since 2013, and we have recently discovered that he may have entered the agency's employ under fraudulent circumstances.
Is Farouk's story credible? Motley asked.
We believe it is.
So you're saying that we have a green badger who has gone rogue and is running terrorist networks under the guise of an official United States government paramilitary operation?
Yes, ma'am, that is our assessment.
To what end?
We don't know at this point. As I said, we just became aware of this a few hours ago. My gut instinct is that Landry is running Muhammad at the behest of another entity, either a rogue state, terrorist organization, or what's termed a super-empowered individual or entity.
I'm not interested in what your gut tells you, Mr. Strain, and I know the term.
What I believe Mr. Strain is trying to say, Janice, is that there isn't evidence that Landry's defection was ideologically driven, Rodriguez interjected.
So what are you proposing we do with this information?
Motley continued without addressing Victor's comment. Strain exhaled before responding.
Ma'am, are you familiar with the pseudo-terrorist operations carried out by the Rhodesian Sella scouts in the 1970s?
Strain could see his boss's eyes widen at the mention of Rhodesia. Motley was African-American, and the racial implications of the Bush War made Rodriguez immediately uncomfortable. Motley showed no reaction.
I am not, Mr. Strain.
Well, they were arguably the most effective counterinsurgency unit in history. They used pseudo-terrorists who were either undercover Rhodesian soldiers or actual former insurgents to infiltrate enemy networks so that they could be targeted by conventional forces. We feel that we have a unique opportunity to utilize Mohammed Farouk in a similar role, and not only take out Amin Nawaz, but also infiltrate additional networks to include ISIS.
You are proposing that, instead of incarcerating Mohammed Farouk for planning the murder of a U.S. general as well as killing and maiming numerous allied troops, we bring him in to work for us?
Yes, ma'am. As horrible as it is to have a rogue CIA agent running an asset against our allies, it also gives us a unique opportunity. As much as I hate to say it, we can take over from Landry and have a highly placed and legitimate asset in a leadership position of a major terrorist organization, not unsimilar to how the DEA infiltrates the cartels. After a pregnant pause, Motley continued,
How exactly would this happen, Mr. Strain?
What did they say? Reese asked, his impatience evident.
Well, they didn't shoot it down. They said they need to think about it. Vic seemed on board. I'm just not sure how to read Motley.
So, what do we do now?
You had a long day of getting kidnapped, so I say we call it.
And then?
Let's plan as if we're going to get the go-ahead.
By noon the following day, the two operatives had come up with a basic concept of operations that involved a direct action mission to capture, kill Amin Nawaz, and the apprehension and rendition of Jules Landry. Either one of these tasks would be tricky to accomplish individually, let alone simultaneously. With multiple unknowns, this was a tough sell, and would be even harder to pull off once Murphy's Law inevitably came into play. They didn't know the location of either Landry or Nawaz and wouldn't be sure of the latter until hours before the operation had to be executed. The entire plan revolved around their absolute trust in Mo, something that both of them hoped was not a naive sentiment. They had plenty of leverage to motivate him, but it was possible, perhaps even likely, he might disappear. Mo had been used by what he now knew to be a rogue CIA operative and had committed atrocities for reasons yet unknown. Reese and Freddy were counting on him, wanting to find out why. A military chain of command would never greenlight such a harebrained operation, but the agency wasn't the U.S. military. By the following morning, Freddy received word from Vic Rodriguez that the plan was tentatively approved on several conditions. That the hit looked like it was done by another Islamic entity, that the United States Department of Justice would formally charge Mo with terror-related crimes, both to cover asses in Washington and to bolster his bona fides as an international terrorist, and, finally, that Landry would not enter U.S. custody at any point during the operation so that his civil rights would not be violated by any U.S. agency or asset. Well, any agency other than the CIA. With those boundaries in place, Reese and Freddy dug into the details of their tactical planning. They were going back to war. Chapter 48. Tirana, Albania, September. The tiny apartment had been abandoned by its occupants, who took little more than the clothes on their backs and what they could fit into a few plastic shopping bags. After years of waiting, their application for asylum in the United Kingdom had been mysteriously granted on the condition that they make the trip within 24 hours. As one of 600 families packed into the squalid conditions of this communist-era housing project with no running water, they didn't have to be asked twice. Institute was arguably the worst neighborhood in Tirana, which was saying something. It smelled of trash, human waste, and terrible food cooked in cramped and poorly ventilated one-room apartments. The unpaved streets were strewn with refuse, and the drab concrete buildings' lone decorations came from the clothing that hung from nearly every window and balcony. The sights and smells reminded Reese of Sadr City and 100 other places he'd fought in since 2001. The only things green were the weeds. Nestled between the Republic of Macedonia to the east and the Adriatic Sea to the west, Albania was struggling with its national identity. Now a market-based economy, member of NATO, and candidate for membership in the European Union, Albania continued to distance itself from its communist past. Montenegro and Kosovo to the north and Greece to the south allowed for ample trading of goods and services as the small Balkan nation worked to shed itself of its former status as North Korea's lone satellite state. Albania's majority Muslim population was not traditionally radical or even particularly devout, and though the country was well known for exporting criminals, it wasn't a breeding ground for terrorism. That changed somewhat as a result of the killing and mass expulsion of Bosnian and Kosovar Muslims during the Balkans War in the 1990s. There is no better way to unite a people than to victimize them by identity. Attempted genocide drew many Muslims in the region closer to their religion. As one of the agency analysts put it during the pre-mission brief, "The Albanians became more radically Islamist during the 1990s the same way that the Irish became more radically Catholic during their conflict with the English in Northern Ireland." Because some Albanians were sympathetic to his cause, and because the government was improving but still dysfunctional, Amin Nawaz found the nation to be a perfect sanctuary on the European Union's periphery. In addition, the terrorist leader had a fondness for prepubescent boys, and one of the destitute families in Institute had offered their son in exchange for what, to them, was a vast sum of money. American troops had been shocked by the pedophilia that they witnessed first in Afghanistan and later in Iraq. Known as Bakhabazi, or boy play in Pashto, this modern-day sex slavery was abhorrent to Westerners, but accepted, or at least tolerated, by many in Central Asia and the Middle East. When drone strikes targeted the meetings of terrorist leaders, young entertainment boys were often found among the dead. As a cell leader, Mo wouldn't ordinarily have knowledge of Amin Nawaz's whereabouts. Sometimes even the inner circle wouldn't know travel plans until the last minute.
This was a basic security protocol for a terrorist organization. However, Moe had known from the start that Landry's request for him to run a terrorist cell was outside of protocol, even for the CIA, and had recognized early in their relationship the need to create some leverage. While still in Syria, Moe had worked to infiltrate Nawaz's inner circle with his own asset, just as the CIA had taught him to do in Iraq. When Nawaz's operations chief was killed in an airstrike by the Assad regime, an Iraqi with impeccable credentials stepped up, one of Moe's team leaders from the STU who had followed him to Syria. Moe was running his own small penetration operation to ensure he remained a valuable asset to who he thought was his CIA handler. This Thursday evening, Nawaz would be visiting with a 9-year-old boy on this muddy street in Tirana's worst slum. Reese and Freddy had been inserted into the city in a baby blue minibus known locally as a furgon. A local driver, who happened to be an agency asset, parked the bus a block from the apartment building at 10 o'clock p.m. and walked inside to visit a girlfriend. Any later and they may have aroused some suspicion by the local residents. Reese and Freddy took turns napping intermittently under blankets on the van's floor until 3 o'clock a.m. They were both dressed in drab local clothing, over multicam combat uniforms worn by Albania's Special Operations Battalion that had supported Allied operations in both Afghanistan and Iraq. Freddy had worked alongside one of the Eagle companies on the Pakistani border and, as a gun and gear nut, knew their weapons and equipment firsthand. Fortunately, most of it was German-made and all of it was good. Reese carried a suppressed MP7, a weapon also conveniently used by the Albanians, inside his jacket. The helmet-mounted night vision devices didn't match their disguises, so they kept them concealed until Moe's hand-drawn map led them to the second-story apartment without incident. Once inside, the two men cleared the small one-room dwelling, confirming they were alone and that the place wasn't wired to blow. A set of jerry-rigged brackets on either side of the door jamb held a 2x4 that Strain quietly slid in place to secure the door. They confirmed their line of sight to the target building and began constructing their urban hide site. Freddy opened his pack and removed a 16.5-inch barreled HK-417 rifle that had been broken down into its lower and upper receivers. He snapped the two halves together and pushed the takedown pins into place to secure them. A Silencer Co. Omega sound suppressor ratcheted onto the muzzle brake, and he loaded a 20-round magazine of Black Hills 175-grain match ammunition into the weapon. To avoid the clang of slamming the bolt home, he slowly worked the charging handle and pushed the receiver's forward assist to ensure that the bolt was seated properly. A small ANPS-13 Golf 1 L3 LWTS thermal optic was mounted to the rifle's top rail, in line with the Schmidt-Bender 3 12x50mm rifle scope. The Albanians had better long-range sniper rifles in their inventory, but this would be a 250-yard shot at the most, and the Select Fire 7.62 would be plenty of gun to get it done. If the operation went south and turned into a firefight, a bolt-action sniper rifle would become a liability, whereas the HK would be an asset. An Atpal PEQ-15 was attached to the rail. Be prepared. All the recent years of urban combat had taught the SEAL sniper community a great deal about life and death by the gun. The apartment's former occupants had been fully debriefed on the interior of their residence, and the notes from that interview had been passed to the sniper pair. A handmade rug, the nicest item in the room, covered the concrete floor from corner to corner. A tattered couch sat against the sidewall, facing a small television with a built-in VHS player. Two mattresses lay on the floor with their sheets neatly folded, and a heavy wooden table with three chairs occupied the room's center. A gas burner rigged to some type of fuel tank alongside two empty buckets served as the kitchen. A bathroom was conspicuously missing. A set of heavy blue curtains hung over a clothesline strung between the barred windows facing the street.
Rhys drew the curtains apart to allow a 12-inch view between them, and attached a dark, lightweight, see-through cloth to the curtain rod using metal binder clips. He unrolled it at an angle, securing it under the legs of the table. The 45-degree angle of the dark yet thin material allowed a sniper to observe a target area in an urban environment through what appeared to be just another empty window from the outside. The two snipers had a clear view to their target building. Freddy took a seat on the opposite side of the table from the window and unfolded the legs of the HK's Atlas bipod. Using the table as a bench rest to support the rifle, he adjusted his position in order to have a better view of the target area. Satisfied the sight was ready, they removed their NOD-equipped helmets, stripped off their hot outer layers of civilian clothing, and settled in for a long day of waiting. Freddy took first watch on the rifle while Rhys sat on one of the mattresses and took charge of their communications. The Harris ANPRC-163 Falcon 3 radio on Rhys's vest was an incredibly capable piece of equipment, more of a computer, really, that did the work it would have taken two radios to do just a few years earlier. With it, he could talk to other units on the ground, satellites in orbit, and even UAVs loitering overhead. He plugged a ruggedized Android tablet into an L3 Technologies Rover 6 and powered it up. Within seconds, a satellite image of their location appeared on the 7-inch screen that looked like a higher-resolution version of Google Earth. Rhys selected a menu that brought up a real-time ISR feed from an MQ-4C Triton drone operating high over the city. Confident all systems were working and were in the correct location, Rhys sent an encrypted message to their operational commander on a vessel in the Adriatic Sea that was also received by higher headquarters back in Virginia. Rhys and Freddy had worked out a schedule in advance. Each man spent an hour on the gun, observing the target area and working on a sketch that included ranges to potential enemy positions, while the other monitored the communications gear and slept. By Rhys's second shift, the dark skies turned to gray and then pink as the new day began. He unclipped the thermal optic from the rail, visualizing possible shot scenarios. Nawaz wasn't expected until that evening, but his plans could change at any moment, and often did, by design. Since most of the terrorist organization's communications were designed to avoid electronic intercept and were therefore slow, it was unlikely that Mo would be aware of a change in time to adapt. They needed a bit of luck. Rhys smiled, remembering an old commanding officer who preached that luck was the residue of preparation. It was 184 meters to the front of the L-shaped building where the young boy lived, and 213 to the side entrance. Both were well within the capabilities of a modern rifle and optic with a trained shooter behind the glass, but the target would likely be moving quickly and could be among a gaggle of other people, some of whom might be civilians. This was where experience and wisdom entered the picture. There was no such thing as an easy shot in the real world. Rhys dialed 0.7 mils of elevation into the scope, which would put the bullet's point of impact dead on at 200 meters. At 175 meters, the shot would be 2 inches high, and at 225, it would be 3 inches low. Not knowing exactly where Nawaz would be clear for a shot, Rhys would make the slight adjustment at game time. That was one of the differences between a marksman and a sniper. By 7 o'clock a.m., most of Institute's residents were out and about. Old women with handkerchiefs tied over their heads carried water in 5-gallon buckets or limped toward the city's markets. Elderly men stood in small groups and smoked, while children in brightly colored jackets and backpacks walked toward what must have been their school. Like nearly all children around the world, these seemed oblivious to the poverty in which they lived. This was simply all they knew. As he watched them, Rhys wondered whether the privileged children of the Western world would be able to compete in the 21st century marketplace with kids like these. Kids who would grow up with hunger, with grit. He fleetingly thought of what amazing assets these children could be to the world, if only they could escape the radicalization efforts of those like the man he hunted. When it was Freddy's turn on the rifle, Reese did a quick check of the radio and tablet before closing his eyes. He smiled to himself, barely able to suppress his laughter, as he thought about a strikingly similar urban sniper hide more than a decade earlier. He and his platoon had been tasked with training and advising an element of Iraqi snipers. His element had made their way into an apartment, similar to the one in which he now found himself, and began the painstaking process of setting up a proper urban hide. Reese was sitting behind the spotting scope, confirming that they had a good perspective on the street below, when an overwhelming odor filled the room. He turned and was shocked to find one of the Iraqi snipers squatting a few feet behind him, defecating on the floor. The Iraqi had no regard for the fact that they were expecting to spend the next 24 to 36 hours living and working in this small space. He had to go. A CIA reports officer summed it up with a saying that gained some traction in theater. The Hodge does what the Hodge does. Maybe Iraq hadn't been as ready for Jeffersonian democracy as U.S. leaders may have hoped. One of Reese's enlisted SEALs took a digital photo of the offending turd on the floor and later displayed the print on the plywood wall of their makeshift bar back at base above a handwritten caption that read, "Real World Shit." Reese managed a few minutes of sleep, and at the top of the hour he and Freddy traded places again. All communication was done using hand signals and facial expressions, since the neighbors would expect the apartment to be empty, and any noise from inside would arouse suspicion. The day dragged on, one rotation after another, observing the landscape of poverty like voyeuristic assassins from the first world. The room grew hot and stuffy, and by midday they had stripped down to T-shirts and removed their low-vis body armor. At dusk, they changed to a sniper-spotter arrangement with one operator on the HK rifle and one seated just behind and to the left so that he could spot using an additional L3 LWTS thermal. Two is one, after all. Because the optics used thermal rather than traditional night vision technology, they worked in both daylight and darkness. Reese was on the rifle when an aging Mercedes microbus parked next to the target building's side entrance, and six military-age males got out and took up security positions around the structure. One of them quickly disappeared into the apartment building. The locals gave them a wide berth. Everything about their behavior indicated that they were an advanced security detail. No weapons were visible, but there was little doubt they were armed. At 7:18 p.m., the ISR feed began tracking an Opel Monterey SUV trailed by a small pickup truck as they steered their way toward the area at a high rate of speed. The two-vehicle convoy fit the profile Moe had described, and the timing was right. The SEAL sniper team observed the area, sending photos back to Langley via the Falcon radio. An hour after their arrival, Reese and Freddy noticed a perceptible shift in the advance team as they assumed a more aggressive posture. A man who appeared to be their leader reemerged from the side entrance along with another man in his 30s and a young boy. They both deduced the second man to be the boy's father. There was no sign of his mother, which was unsurprising in the Muslim world and likely also due to the nature of the transaction that was about to take place. The boy was dressed in a white, cone-shaped chalesha cap, fustanella dress-like shirt, and chamadan vest, and wore an embroidered brez sash around his waist. His parents had clad their young son in traditional Albanian dress, like he was some type of doll to make him a more hospitable sex toy for the visiting terrorist leader. The sight of it sickened both men, and Freddy was happy to be the one who would be able to put a bullet into the pedophile before he could violate this innocent child. He suppressed the urge to put a second bullet into the boy's father. Reese began whispering updates from the ISR feed as the SUV approached the target. 5 minutes out. 2 minutes out.
30 seconds out, he's passing our position. Both men watched the silver SUV and pickup pass down the gravel roadway below and to the right of their position as they steered toward the target building's side entrance. It stopped next to the curb along with the truck, the back of which was filled with armed men. The headache hit Reese with blinding speed and a pain worse than he'd yet experienced. An audible grunt and the thud of the handheld thermal hitting the floor took Freddy off the gun.
"Reese, you okay?"
Reese pushed as hard as he could on his temples as the pain continued to radiate and blind him.
"Reese,"
Freddy whispered, looking back to the scene playing out in the streets below.
"Reese, shit!"
Then he was gone.
"I'm okay. It's all right,"
Reese said, regaining his senses.
"Get back in the game, buddy. How far to the SUV?"
his visibly concerned friend asked. Reese picked up the thermal and consulted the range card they'd built in daylight.
210 to the SUV, he reported.
Taking a breath, he studied the laundry hanging from the building's windows.
"Wind is swirling, less than 5. Hold dead on."
A half dozen men piled out of the truck's bed carrying a mix of Kalashnikov-style rifles that varied in barrel length and national origin. Some carried them slung over their backs, and all of them had their stocks folded to make the weapons more compact. They surrounded the SUV with 4 on the side near the building and 2 remaining on the street side of the vehicle. All 4 doors of the SUV opened, and Reese heard the metallic sound of strain moving the selector switch to fire. An overweight man in his 50s stepped from the back seat of the Opel and was immediately flanked by the 4 security men. Though they saw him for only a brief moment, both Reese and Freddy were confident that he was their target. Amin Nawaz knelt by the vehicle, becoming totally obscured from view by his detail. He must have waved the boy over as he was prodded forward by his father and then walked sheepishly toward the stranger. The boy disappeared into the rugby scrum of terrorists until his head popped up. Nawaz had him seated on his shoulders like a father carrying his child at a carnival.
Shit, no shot.
"What's the situation? Over?"
the radio headphone cackled in Reese's ear.
"What asshole in Langley thinks this is a good time to be on the net?"
He did not respond to the ridiculous query. Freddy exhaled deeply as he struggled with what had effectively become a hostage situation and the ultimate sniper's dilemma. The gaggle of men began to move toward the door, the SEAL shooter tracking the position of Nawaz's head as it bobbed among the men of his security detail. Between the risk of hitting the boy and the low probability of a clean hit on the target among his security men, there was nothing the snipers could do but watch. 10 seconds after placing the boy on his shoulders, Nawaz and his detail were safely inside the building.
"Fuck!"
Freddy whispered a bit too loudly, putting the weapon back on safe.
"You didn't have a shot, buddy. You did the right thing.
Okay, 2 options. Assault the building, or wait to take him out when he exits."
"There's what, 12 bad guys that we know of?"
"Yeah, I counted 12.
We wait him out." "Damn it. I can't stand the thought of what's going to happen to that kid while we wait. Fucking savages,"
Freddy hissed.
"I know, Freddy, me neither. But there isn't a damn thing we can do about that at the moment."
"Why in the hell wouldn't they authorize a drone strike on this vehicle on its way here in the first place?"
Freddy said, even though he knew the answer.
"Politics with, in this case, a heavy dose of practicality. We need to protect Moe's cover to keep him a valuable asset to the U.S. government. A drone strike would look like exactly what it is, a U.S. assassination. We need this to look like an Albanian operation. We have to sit tight and take him on the way out."
Chapter 49. Edirne, Turkey. September. Moe had signaled to Jules Landry that he needed to meet in person. The method was a simple one. A cryptic message left in the draft folder of the private messaging system on a web forum dedicated to stamp collecting. Both men had a shared login and accessed the system on a regular basis to check for unsent messages left for each other. The same method was commonly used on webmail services, but the NSA was doing a better job of monitoring accounts with no incoming and outgoing emails, so the Swiss-based Filatelli server provided an extra layer of protection for those who adapted in a tech-based world. General David Petraeus had used a similar technique with his mistress until a random series of events led to its discovery by the FBI. Landry set up the meeting just outside the Greek-influenced city of Edirne near Turkey's border with Bulgaria, so that he could use one of his EU passports to escape westward if something went wrong. He walked down the gray and white mosaic sidewalks of the city and climbed into his small rental Mercedes sedan. He'd spent the night locally and had scouted the route and the meeting site. Even in his chemically altered state, he remembered his tradecraft. The road from town headed north across a narrow stone bridge. Landry breathed easier once his car was past the choke point and over the wide open swamp beyond. He turned right at the intersection and could see the ruins of the Ottoman palace ahead. Pulling the car off the road, he parked on the grass, choosing to walk the last 100 meters of open farmland. The twilight air was cool, and Landry was glad to be wearing a jacket. He had found that black leather made you all but invisible in this part of the world. His dark hair didn't hurt either. He saw little sign of activity as he approached the ruins. It was primarily an agricultural area, not prone to crowds of tourists. Unlike most of Europe, or anywhere in the United States, this historical site was open to the world with no fences, gates, or price of admission. It was simply part of the town. He saw someone leaning against the opening of the Felicity Gate, a preserved doorway of what was left of a crumbled brick palace wall. Even at this distance, he could tell it was Mo. The man smiled as he approached. Mo jerked his head toward the larger labyrinth of ruins, Landry following a few steps behind. They passed under a columned archway and into one of the few standing rooms among the remains of the once imposing structure. Mo lit a cigarette. That was the signal. As Landry stepped inside, an electric stun baton emerged from the shadows and administered 2.5 microcoulombs and 30,000 volts just below his hip. He fell forward without the ability to raise his arms and crashed face down onto the rocky ground. Mo and his paid accomplice worked quickly and had Landry flex-cuffed, with duct tape added for good measure, gagged, searched, drugged with a heavy dose of benzodiazepines, and rolled into a thick rug within minutes. They carried him into a delivery van filled with local carpets and hid him among the cargo. Mo powered off Landry's phone and zipped it into a bag designed to block all incoming and outgoing signals to prevent tracking, and pocketed his car keys to dispose of along the route. Mo handed his accomplice an envelope of cash and bid him farewell before hoisting himself into the van and turning the key to begin the long trek toward the Ibrahim Khalil border crossing. Mo was headed home. Chapter 50. Tirana, Albania, September. The waiting was brutal. Not only were Reese and Freddie under the stress of the mission and the breakdown of the original plan, but they had to effectively stand by while an innocent child endured unspeakable abuse. The men's thoughts wandered to their own children, both living and deceased. Reese knew that Freddie would be thinking of his son, Sam. He couldn't switch off being a father, no matter how hard you trained. At 9 o'clock p.m., Reese took his place behind the rifle. Dusk had turned to darkness, but the clear visual through the thermal optic turned night almost to day. The security men outside the building glowed bright white through the scope, the warm concrete standing out against the cool ground beside it. Reese turned on the illuminated mil-dot police reticle of the S&B rifle scope, the glowing red crosshairs giving him better contrast against the grayscale thermal image. Despite a population of 3,500 residents, The grounds surrounding the apartment buildings were all but deserted. No children playing, no old men smoking, no women walking to or from the nearby shopping areas. The locals knew that something was going on. They didn't need to be told. This was home. They could sense it. The only signs of life came from televisions flickering in windows and the sounds of conversations echoing down the hallway outside their door. 35 minutes into Reese's shift, the perimeter guard's behavior changed. The boss was coming out. 4 men emerged from the building's side entrance and walked to the SUV, opening the doors. Now that darkness had fallen, the men were brandishing their weapons openly. 6 at the truck, 6 on the perimeter. Reese moved the rifle selector back to fire and steadied the toe of the buttstock against the beanbag-like rear rest on the table. 2 more armed men emerged from the building and stopped halfway to the vehicle, facing outward. Reese took a deep breath, exhaled slowly, and prepared himself for a precise shot. The security detail lead emerged next, with the shorter and heavier Nawaz trailing behind him. Reese took another breath and exhaled as he began to track the white-hot moving target with his crosshairs. The leader waved his hand toward the 2 men standing in front of them. They began to walk back in his direction. Reese had mere seconds before the target would be surrounded by security men. He continued to track the target, holding the crosshairs on the front of Amin Nawaz's chest as he increased pressure on the trigger. Even suppressed, the shot was loud inside the confines of the room, especially after the men had worked in near silence for hours. The 175-grain open-tip match bullet passed across the open courtyard in a quarter of a second before slamming into Nawaz's right arm. The bullet shattered the humerus on its way into his thoracic cavity, where it center-punched a rib, sending shards of bone into his lung like shrapnel. The bullet continued its slightly downward path as it shredded its way through both lungs and exited on the offside of his body, spraying blood, bone, and even bits of his ample body hair across the graveled ground. His security man heard the sickening thwack of the bullet's impact an instant before the supersonic crack of the bullet's travel reached their ears. Nawaz lunged forward and down, crashing into his chief bodyguard. The security detail quickly became disoriented in the darkness, unsure how to react. They'd obviously spent their time intimidating civilians instead of rehearsing immediate action drills. Amin Nawaz lay face down, gasping unsuccessfully for breath as his lungs filled with blood. The 2 men closest to him finally reacted and began dragging his limp body toward the idling Opel. Reese and Freddy could hear the men yelling at one another as the rest of the team raced to surround their fallen leader.
"Hedgehog down, I say again, hedgehog down, over," Freddy reported over the radio in a calm, even tone.
"Roger that, hedgehog down," a distant command voice responded.
"Spartan, this is Renegade 2-2, over," an animated voice joined in.
"I've got you, Renegade, preparing to move."
"Roger that, I'm 10 mics out."
"Good copy."
Within 10 seconds of Freddy's radio call to Langley, the entire city of Tirana went dark. Agency hackers had breached a firewall for the Albanian power corporation, known as Kesh, a week earlier, and, with the target down, they signaled the servers to discontinue distribution of electricity to that sector of the nation's power grid. The hydroelectric plants continued to make power. The distribution points simply stopped relaying it. With Institute now thrown into absolute blackness, save for what came from the quarter moon, the terrorists' panic level increased exponentially. As Reese and Freddy worked swiftly to ready their gear, they heard shots ring out. At first it was a few isolated bursts, but the rest of the men caught on, and soon full auto gunfire was spraying in almost every direction. The suppressor had eliminated the rifle's muzzle flash and had muffled the report, so it was doubtful the men outside knew from which building the shot had originated. Their reaction was to wildly pump rounds into every structure in the vicinity in what professionals referred to as a death blossom.
"Renegade 2-2,
This is Spartan, hot extract. I say again, hot extract, over.
Roger that, Spartan. 8 mics out, a voice responded over the sound of a screaming diesel motor in the background.
Both operators had put on their helmets with the distinctive four-eyed NODs in place. Freddy had the magazines for the 7.62mm HK sniper rifle in his vest, so he carried the larger rifle. Reese checked the Atpal laser on his little MP7 submachine gun and nodded to his partner, who removed the 2x4 blocking the door and opened it, allowing Reese to creep into the deserted hallway. The sniper pair moved quickly but quietly toward the stairwell at the end of the hall, hearing animated voices from the apartments they passed. The residents of Institute were apparently unhappy with the power being shut off during their prime TV watching time, not to mention the hail of bullets just outside their doors. They made it to the stairs and took the 2 flights down in seconds, pausing at the bottom to ensure that the hallway was clear. Halfway down the narrow ground floor hallway, a beam of light washed out their night vision and they heard a female scream. A surprised young woman dropped a flashlight and sprinted down the hall. The men raced to catch her, but she had too much of a head start.
"Polisi! Polisi!"
she screamed as she burst through the metal doors and out into the open area between the buildings, pointing back the way she'd come. Reese rounded the corner just in time to see a burst of tracers cut her down, the fire shifting to the doors. He dove back inside as the bullets impacted the concrete walls and metal doors, sending shards of dust and debris across the small entryway. Back on his feet, he and Freddy made their way swiftly toward the building's only other exit. When they reached the side door, which was propped open with a rock the size of a soccer ball, they saw the headlights of a pickup truck racing toward their position. One of the terrorists riding in the bed of the truck had a belt-fed PKM machine gun resting over the cab and began firing toward the open doorway. Both men dropped to the ground and Freddy began firing methodically toward the PKM's muzzle flash while Reese put a long burst into the truck's windshield. The firing stopped and the engine's whine slowed to an idle. The truck's momentum carried it forward as the pace slowed while both operators shifted their fire to the headlights. The lull in the fire was temporary as the enemy began to zero in on the American's location. Within moments, more small arms fire impacted around the doorway.
"I'll cover the other door," Reese yelled over the gunfire. "How far out is Ox?"
"Renegade 2-2, what's your ETA, over?"
Freddy called over the radio.
"Under 5, I say again, under 5.
Reese heard the transmission and flashed Freddy a thumbs up as he jogged down the hallway. Rounds still passed through both of the building's openings, preventing either man from returning effective fire. Green tracers from a belt-fed weapon ricocheted as they impacted the walls of the hallway, and 5.45mm AK rounds hit in a less frequent but equally deadly tempo. Reese slowly worked an angle on the doorway, firing short bursts as enemy muzzle flashes worked their way into his line of sight.
"I need a window,"
Reese heard his frustrated teammate call out. Seconds later, he heard the sound of a door being kicked in and the screams of the residents inside. The window gave Freddy a better position, and after he dropped 2 terrorists with as many shots, the firing from that side of the building abated as the survivors took cover behind the bullet-laden pickup truck.
"Moving your way,"
Reese said into his radio. Freddy fired repeated rounds into the truck to keep the enemy's heads down as Reese moved to exit the side door, scanning the area outside to ensure that he wasn't going to walk into a burst of machine gun fire. Satisfied that it was as quiet as it was going to get, he sprinted through the door and ran around to the back side of the apartment building, where he took a knee to cover Freddy's exit. He didn't have to say a word. Instead, he fired short bursts from his MP7 under the pickup, his laser dancing across the open ground. 2 of the rounds caught a shooter in the shin and he fell to his side, grasping his leg. The next burst hit his face. Freddy moved past Reese and took cover behind a small car, firing toward the enemy. They leapfrogged slowly, putting distance between themselves and the terrorist gunmen. The scene was First World versus Third, trained versus untrained, disciplined versus undisciplined. Reese and Freddy moved, fired and changed magazines with practiced discipline while the terrorists sprayed rounds wildly on full automatic. The technological advantage of the NODs and IR laser-equipped former frogmen was almost unfair. The terrorists fired at fleeting sounds and shadows while Reese and Freddy could clearly see not only the enemy but each other's lasers. To the commanders and analysts stateside watching the scene from the black-and-white UAV feed, it was like watching a video game with the sound muted. IR strobes blinked on top of the helmets of the good guys, while the bad guys' muzzle flashes identified them with nearly equal clarity. Rick Ox Andrews had earned his nickname as a 19-year-old Ranger Private First Class by running across the runway of the Port Salinas Airport in Grenada under fire, laden like an ox with a mortar tube across his shoulders and belts of linked M60 ammunition crisscrossing his chest. He'd fought in nearly every armed conflict since that October day in 1983 and had served as a sergeant major in the Army's premier special operations unit before going to work for the CIA's ground branch in 2004. The special operations world was a small one, and he and Reese had crossed paths more than once in both Iraq and Afghanistan. 30 seconds out, Ox called over the radio as he wove the green Land Rover Defender 90 toward the firefight around parked and slower-moving cars. He flipped his NODs down as he neared the target, his path illuminated by the vehicle's IR headlights. As soon as he did, he saw the beam from the powerful laser co-witnessed with the sights of the machine gun mounted on the rover's roll bar. He hit the brakes, careful not to bounce his gunner around too badly, and turned sharply. The turn put them perpendicular to the pickup with the enemy totally exposed. Ox winced as the 12.7mm Dishkim machine gun came alive above his head, its 855-grain armor-piercing incendiary bullets tearing the men, their weapons, and the truck behind them to shredded bits of flesh and metal. Ox steered past the pickup and caught sight of the IR beams from Reese's and Freddy's ATPLs 200 meters ahead. He accelerated in their direction and saw one of their flashing IR strobes emerge from behind a compact car as he closed the distance. As he rolled to a stop, Reese opened the passenger side door and climbed inside. He heard Freddy tumble into the truck's bed, and the massive gunner, whom they'd nicknamed Django after the movie character, slapped the truck's roof. Ox consulted the night vision compatible LCD screen attached to the truck's dash as he accelerated away from the objective, confirming over his Peltor headset that their ride was inbound. Reese changed magazines in the passenger seat and looked through the rover's back window to see Strain covering the truck's rear with his rifle. Full head count. He let Ox handle the navigation as he ran through a mental checklist and subconsciously checked over his gear with his left hand. Full mag in the gun and one more in the vest. All Reese could see were buildings lining the darkened city streets as Ox wove his way toward the extraction point, his goggled head shifting between the road ahead and the screen to his right. "Good to see you, buddy," Ox said as he drove. Reese could see his trademark grin below his NODs. "Damn good to see you, Ox. We appreciate the ride." "No worries, man. Somebody's got to keep you Navy guys out of trouble." Ox steered the truck off the road and drove through a side yard between two houses at 50 miles per hour. As they crossed the open field, a black shadow descended before them out of the heavens. The sound came next, the twin blades roaring through the night sky, the rotor wash forcing the high grass flat against the ground. Ox hit the brakes but was still moving at a faster pace than Reese had expected when he steered the Land Rover up the metal ramp of the MH-47G Chinook. It was a tight fit, too tight to open the truck's doors, but the Defender fit into the helicopter's cargo bay like it was made for it. Ox engaged the parking brake and shut off the engine, flashing a thumbs up to the flight engineer. Seconds later, the pilot from the 160th Special Operations Aviation Regiment added power and lifted off. As the Hilo gained altitude and turned west toward the Adriatic Sea, Amin Nawaz's dead body lay cooling in the back seat of the Opel, his frantic driver speeding to exit the city. Within an hour, cable news outlets were reporting that the terrorist leader had been killed in a raid by Albanian commandos, and an hour after that report, the actual commandos from Albania's Eagle 5 arrived on the scene of the firefight in their Dishkam-armed olive-green Land Rover Defender 90s. Thanks to a tip provided to the nation's state intelligence service, the Albanian Shish recovered the terrorist leader's abandoned body in a discarded vehicle a few kilometers outside Tirana. Chapter 51. Turkey-Iraq border, September. It took the two-vehicle convoy 10 hours to reach the border. After passing through the town of Silopi, Turkey, Mo and his men crossed the Khabur River and approached the arched frontier gate at Ibrahim Khalil. The men manning the border were Kurdish Peshmerga, the most pro-U.S. troops in Iraq. Despite guarding an international border on behalf of their nation, they wore the sunburst flag of Kurdistan on their U.S.-made woodland BDUs, rather than the flag of Iraq. Kurdistan was a nation within a nation, a place the CIA never really left after 1991. The officer in charge of the checkpoint pointed toward a white Ford F-250 with a PKM machine gun mounted in the rear, operated by a balaclava-wearing Kurd dressed in desert tiger stripe. CIA. The skids had already been greased, and Mo passed through the checkpoint unhindered. Two Ford trucks with gunners manning the big guns in their beds fell in with Mo's van, one in front and one behind. Mo gave them a nod and a thumbs up, following the lead vehicle in what was now a CIA convoy, returning to a country he had vowed never to set foot in again. Mo briefly wondered if Landry would survive the journey. It was a long distance to travel wrapped up in a rug with feet, hands, and mouth secured with duct tape, and decided this was an appropriate time for an inshallah. The agency operated with absolute autonomy in Kurdistan even during the Saddam years. They had organized a coup there in 1995, one that was thwarted not by Hussein or his secret police, but by the National Security Advisor in the White House. The CIA and Iraqi dissidents had planned the coup early in 1995, but at the last minute, the White House lost its nerve. Despite having two divisions and a brigade of the Iraqi army ready to defect to the anti-Saddam forces, agency personnel received a last-minute cable from Washington ordering them to stand down. Mo had no idea whether the plan for a coup would have succeeded, but having seen far too much bloodshed in the chaos that followed Saddam's removal in 2003, he believed the risk would have been worth it. He briefly wondered what his life would be like had that coup succeeded, but quickly brushed the thought aside. He had work to do in the present, an assignment to break and question his treacherous cargo. The tables were turned, and soon Landry would answer for his sins. Chapter 52. Aboard the USS Kearsarge, LHD-3, Adriatic Sea, September. The Chinook landed on the deck of the amphibious assault ship under the cover of darkness, the only illumination on deck coming from a strip of green landing lights. Reese, Strain, Ox, and Django climbed out of the Defender through the top of its roll cage and down the helo's rear ramp, while the aircraft and deck crews worked swiftly to move the MH-47 onto the elevator that would take it to a hangar below decks. A desert cami-clad Marine First Lieutenant from the 26th Marine Expeditionary Unit led the men across the deck and inside through a steel hatch. All four commandos squinted as their eyes adjusted to the bright fluorescent lights of the ship's interior while their escort led them through the labyrinth of corridors. Members of the ship's crew stepped aside to let the visitors pass in the narrow space, eyeing the mysterious armed men with curiosity. The beards, nylon chest rigs, and salt-stained multicam combat clothing worn by the agency men contrasted sharply with the blue and gray aquaflage worn by the clean-cut sailors of the conventional Navy.
Wonder what admiral ever approved that uniform, Reese thought. Reese hadn't been able to catch up with Ox much during the flight due to the noise. Now he was directly behind the Army legend as they moved through the bowels of what Reese often termed a big gray ship, due to his mysterious inability to tell them apart.
"Aren't you getting too old for this, Ox? Happy 70th birthday, by the way. Sorry I missed it."
"Easy, Reese. I'm not even 60. Besides, the way my wife spends money, I can't afford to retire.
I can still drive and shoot as long as I don't forget my glasses."
"Well, you must be the Dorian Gray of Redacted."
"Who?"
Ox asked. "Never mind."
"Just don't ask him how to work the comms," the usually stoic Django deadpanned over his shoulder.
"Yeah, I need to start bringing one of my grandkids along to work the radios," Ox shot back at his partner. "Why do they make those things so complicated?"
Their marine escort motioned to a closed hatch, and the men shifted to a more professional demeanor as they entered the room for the mission debrief. The room was fairly large by ship standards and was one of the ready rooms for the LHD's helo pilots. A Marine Helicopter Squadron logo adorned the hatch, as well as the podium at the front of the room, where two men and a woman, all dressed in civilian clothes, waited.
"Great job, boys. Fantastic work. Mr. Strain, you and your friend here are going to make me take back all of the bad things I've ever said about SEALs. Mr. Reese, I'm Vic Rodriguez. Very nice to meet you."
Reese was never a great judge of height, but he guessed Rodriguez at 5'6". He was a handsome man with short salt-and-pepper hair and olive skin that made his age hard to guess. Dressed in khaki pants, hiking boots, and a black polo shirt, he was fit and had an energetic air that made him immediately likable. The two men shook hands, Rodriguez smiling warmly. He motioned toward the other individuals in the room and introduced them. Reese recognized Nicole Fan, the analyst from the video conference in Istanbul. She looked even younger in person.
"Guys, this is Major Dave Harper. He's a liaison from
Redacted," Rodriguez said, introducing the thin man with the high and tight haircut.
"Great job out there. I'm just here to coordinate the air, ground, and sea assets for this. Here to help however I can."
"Those helo pilots were nothing short of incredible," Reese said. "Please thank them for us."
"Will do," the Army major said with a nod.
The ship's galley had the room catered, and the food, true to Navy form, was actually not bad, though Reese hadn't forgotten the differences between eating in the officer's mess and the enlisted one, night and day. Reese and Freddy ate like they'd been shipwrecked for weeks before beginning the hot wash. He led them through each phase of the mission, answering questions from Rodriguez, Fan, and Harper as they went. The UAV images were displayed on the room's LCD screen, and the men gave play-by-play narratives from their perspective on the ground. Reese had been through hundreds of similar debriefs during his time in special operations, though none were as sensitive or as classified as this one. Following the 3-hour meeting, Harper called for an escort to show the men to their assigned sleeping quarters. Rodriguez shook Reese's hand on the way out and spoke in a muted voice.
"Great work, Reese. Get some sleep. There's something I want to discuss with you in the morning."
Reese bid him good night, wondering what the morning's conversation would entail.
Chapter 53. Reese slept well. The ship's gentle roll a muted reminder of his time at sea aboard the Beneteau. That voyage seemed like years ago now. He dreamt of the ocean, how it offered him refuge, tested him, and delivered him to what? He wasn't yet sure. Voices passing outside the hatch of the small stateroom rousted him from a deep slumber. Reese stared silently into the pitch-black darkness and tried to remember where he was. After realizing that he hadn't failed Buds and been assigned to the fleet, he swung his feet onto the deck and felt for his Navy-supplied shower shoes with his toes. The ship's company had left a package of new white t-shirts and a blue coverall jumpsuit for him on the bunk. He couldn't bring himself to put on the coveralls, but he put on one of the fresh t-shirts and pulled on the Cry multicam pants that he'd worn on the Albania op. He brushed his hair back with his hands as best he could and put on a sweat-stained Padres cap he'd found under the bed. Heading out into the passageway and into the bustling heart of the ship during the morning watch, Rhys asked directions to the ward room and wandered in that direction. Navigating the internal passageways of a ship had never come easily to him. Rhys eventually found it with the help of a seaman apprentice who looked about 12, and he wasn't surprised to see Ox already there when he arrived. He caught some strange looks from the khaki uniform-wearing officers seated at one of the tables and begrudgingly took off his hat. He wasn't sure why he worried about it, the normal decorum of the officer's mess having already been shattered by the pasty white former Army NCO clad in a tight t-shirt and a pair of black Ranger panty PT shorts, far too much of his anatomy on full display. The ship's officers apparently knew better than to say anything to the barrel-chested operator sitting by himself. "Ox, you still wearing those Speedos in public? I think there's a regulation of some sort against that in the 21st century military. You realize there are women on Navy ships now, right? You remind me of the old chiefs at Coronado who were still rocking UDT shorts when I showed up as a new guy." "Nothing more comfortable, brother. I'm not giving these things up. Get some coffee and come join me." Ox motioned to an urn full of the Navy's best jet fuel on a table nearby. Rhys filled his cup and doctored it carefully with sweetener and milk, a bit disappointed at the lack of honey. "Good thing they do have women on ships now, Rhys, otherwise you'd have to drink it black, like a man." Rhys gave his friend the one-finger salute over his shoulder, then took a seat at the round table, where his friend read a computer printout of a news story through a pair of half glasses. "What's happening in the world today, Ox?"
"Well, it says here that some Albanian commandos killed the most wanted terrorist in the world in a firefight last night."
"No kidding. Good for them."
"Yeah, pretty crazy. Says here in all that chaos, somebody put a single round through his lungs."
"Wow. Kind of sounds like when Colombian forces killed Pablo Escobar," Rhys said with a conspiratorial smile. Ox looked at Rhys over his glasses.
"Very similar, my friend. Very similar."
"Are we the only ones up? What time is it?"
"Ha! It's 09:30, Rhys. Everyone has been up for hours. Freddy and Vic are off somewhere doing admin, and Django is in the gym staying huge. He must have eaten a dozen eggs this morning. You need some chow?"
"No, I'm good with coffee for now." Rhys drank his Java in silence, still trying to clear his mind from the fog of sleep while Ox droned on about something. 20 minutes later, Vic Rodriguez walked into the wardroom dressed in pressed casual clothes, showered, shaved, and looking sharp.
"Good morning, Mr. Rhys. Ox, glad to see that you haven't moved in 2 hours."
"Just catching up on the news, boss."
Rodriguez rolled his eyes.
"Rhys, is this a good time for us to talk?"
"Good a time as any, I guess."
"Let's head topside. Top off your coffee if you'd like."
Rhys nodded to Ox, who flashed him a grin as he refilled his coffee, and followed the agency man toward the upper deck. The irony was not lost on him that, as a career naval officer, he had to follow a former soldier to find his way through the ship. Vic led him through a hatch and onto the windswept flight deck. A crew member nodded to him and pointed toward the stern. This had obviously been arranged ahead of time. The two men stopped aft of the ship's superstructure, a few feet from the deck's edge, the chained railing the only thing between them and a long drop into the Adriatic Sea below. They were mostly out of the wind, but it was still present enough that no one standing more than 10 feet away would be able to eavesdrop on their conversation, and no member of the ship's crew was within anything close to that distance. They had complete privacy. Rodriguez got right to the point.
"Rhys, I want to thank you for what you've done. Because of your efforts, the most wanted terrorist in the world is a corpse.
Global markets are reacting to the news as we speak. We had a deal. As far as the U.S. government is concerned, you're a free man.
I appreciate that, Vic. I get the feeling there's a but here, though.
You're right, Reese. There's a but. You don't owe us a thing, but we sure could use you. I am offering you a job, no strings attached. You'd be a green badger, a contract guy. You know what that means. It's not a bad deal, and you get to see this thing through.
Reese took a sip of coffee and stared out at the choppy green water on the horizon. Rodriguez continued.
Okay, I guess you're going to make me sell it. You know what kind of evil is out there. You've been in these countries. Amin Nawaz was a big get for us, but someone is going to take his place tomorrow, smarter and even more determined. We need people we can count on to hunt these assholes down to the ends of the earth. And here's the other part. That plan that you came up with to flip Mo and use him as a pseudo-terrorist? It's brilliant, but I need you here to run it, or else it'll get fucked up. You know that. Major Farouk, Mo as you call him, is on his way into Iraq with Landry right now. This isn't over by a long shot.
Reese nodded and took another sip of coffee, glad his friend was still alive and well.
Listen, Reese, I don't know you personally, but I know your reputation. I've read all your evals, fit reps, and medal citations, but more importantly, Freddy and Ox think the world of you. Come work for me. You do what you're good at, and I deal with the politics and the red tape.
Reese looked Rodriguez in the eye. You really think they're going to let me go? They're just going to forget about all the people I killed?
Reese, all I know is that I can't protect you if you're not under my wing. Give me a few months on the job, focus on the mission, and I'll provide top cover. If you decide later that you want to walk, I won't try to stop you.
Reese was silent for a full minute as he weighed the different scenarios. He started to say no, but stopped himself, looking out to sea, remembering the voyage from Fishers to Mozambique, his family, the tumor, and Katie. In the end, he made the decision for Mohammed, his friend with whom he had shared the bond of combat. This wasn't over. Mo had been played. He'd been played by a sociopath who had found his way into an intelligence agency that gave him the freedom to feed his sick fantasies, and somebody, possibly in the agency itself, was running that sociopath. This wasn't over, and Reese couldn't walk until it was. He couldn't leave Mo halfway through the operation. To Reese, that was the same thing as leaving him behind on the battlefield. Vic was right. Reese needed to see it through.
You forgot to mention something, Vic.
Oh, what's that?
That you read my psyche, Val. That you knew I'd say yes.
Vic smiled.
Well, true. There is that.
Reese paused. I'm saying yes to finishing this operation. And then I'm out. Vic Rodriguez smiled again and extended his hand.
Welcome to the team, Reese. Surgery is planned either at Bethesda or at your clinic in La Jolla as soon as this is over. And by the way, you've got some money coming your way. We made it a condition of you coming on board that you got to keep the reward money for Nawaz. It was coming from the British government, so we worked it in as a term of your employment. It's a sizable chunk. Figured you could use it to get a fresh start.
That might just about cover my old Land Cruiser, and I owe more than a few people beers. I do have one request to make, though.
What's that?
I need you to track down a phone number for me. After a pause and some clicks and beeps as the Iridium satellite phone connected, Reese heard it begin to ring. He was more nervous than he thought he would be. He hoped she'd answer the strange number.
Come on, pick up.
He thought of all the times he'd called Lauren on the same type of phone, the same clicks and beeps followed by the strange satellite-transformed voice that made loved ones sound like aliens from another world. He'd always told her that everything was okay and not much was going on, even as he looked up at the night sky following a mission in which everything was not okay. No matter how tired he was, he always made time to call, feeling it was his responsibility to use the technical advantages afforded him that were not available to his late father in Vietnam or his grandfather in World War II.
"This is Katie."
Pause. Katie?
"Yes?" Hello, anyone there?
Even through the Iridium satellite link, he could detect her slight hint of an accent that most people wouldn't even notice.
Shit, what am I, in junior high? "Hello?"
she said again. Paralyzed, Reese remembered her on her knees with debt cord twisted around her neck, with the thumb of a SEAL-turned-CIA operative-turned-mercenary on the detonator.
"Reese, how did you know Ben didn't have that detonator connected? How did you know he wouldn't blow my head off?"
"Shit," Reese said out loud, hitting the end call button. "I didn't." Chapter 54. Kurdistan, Iraq. September. Landry thought he was going to die. As whatever drugs they'd given him wore off, panic began to set in. It didn't help that he was beginning to experience withdrawal symptoms from the cocktail of recreational and prescription drugs that had become his mainstay. His wrists and ankles were bound, there was tape over his mouth and eyes, and he was wrapped in something heavy. The heat was stifling, and the pillowcase over his head only exacerbated the claustrophobic conditions. The only sounds he could hear were those of tires on various combinations of asphalt, gravel, and dirt as the vehicle traveled for what seemed like days, his brain having no reference points to maintain his sense of equilibrium. He dry-heaved repeatedly from motion sickness, his clothing soaked in sweat and urine. His brain raced to process what had happened. He lived a paranoid existence as it was, expecting betrayal at nearly every moment. He struggled to make sense of what had gone wrong. Betrayed by Mo, but to who and for what? Had Mo found out he wasn't really a CIA asset continuing his work for the United States government he'd started in Iraq? This was more than misery. This was pushing Landry into the land of the insane. He squinted his eyes shut, trying to make this nightmare end, only to open them to the darkness of the tape and hood. His muffled screams the only outlet for what had turned into an anxiety attack without end. The van accelerated over gravel, made several sharp turns, and finally came to a stop, brakes squeaking. The driver was speaking to someone outside, and Landry heard the doors open. Whatever he was wrapped in was jerked from the vehicle. He landed on the ground with an unceremonious thud and rolled sideways as the rug unraveled. The effect was dizzying. Landry attempted to gasp for air, thwarted by the tape across his mouth. "It must be night," he thought, feeling the cool air against his skin. He could hear the distant hum of generators. The scrape of a metal door penetrated the darkness, and he was carried face down by what felt like four men into a building of some kind. The footfalls of boots sounded as if they were walking on a concrete floor, and he heard various doors open and shut in front of and behind them. No voices. The movement stopped, and he was dropped onto the hard floor, his chin splitting on impact. He heard a strange sound that he couldn't identify until he realized it was a pair of EMT shears cutting the clothing from his body. The room was freezing cold, and he felt increasingly chilled as his skin was exposed to the air. His boots were pulled from his feet, and he was left totally naked on the cold, hard floor. The door slammed shut, and hands still bound with zip ties and duct tape, he curled up in a ball, shivering and convulsing, on the verge of madness. Chapter 55. Over the Mediterranean Sea,
September.
Their flight took close to 3 hours and nearly maxed out the V-22's fuel capacity. It was Reese's first time riding in the tilt-rotor aircraft, and though part of him thought it was an incredible feat of engineering, the almost 40-something part of his brain couldn't help but remember how many times these aircraft had crashed during development. He and Freddy sat in the folding seats that lined the walls of the aircraft's cargo bay, which, to Reese's untrained eye, looked like a smaller version of the Chinook's interior. The inside of the fuselage was covered in an endless tangle of wires, metal lines, and hoses like something out of some steampunk artist's fantasy. Reese thought of one of Ox's favorite sayings. If you get in a helicopter and it's not leaking, get ready to crash, because that means it's out of hydraulic fluid. He looked up to see whether anything was dripping. The marine pilots steered them over the open Mediterranean before going feet dry over Turkey and finally passing into the airspace of northern Iraq. Their landing at Erbil International Airport was conventional by Iraqi standards, unlike the dive bomber-like landings they'd all endured during approaches into Baghdad International Airport. The surface-to-air threat must be pretty light here these days. Their headsets allowed them to hear the chatter on the bird's intercom, which mainly consisted of the pilots conveying information to the crew chief riding with them in the cargo bay. It was all very routine. Reese was curious whether the Osprey would land vertically or horizontally, but due to the generous runway, it touched down like a traditional fixed-wing aircraft. Probably safer that way. After a short taxi, the twin-turbine engines shut down, and the rear ramp was lowered. Reese and Freddy went forward to thank the pilots and crew for the ride before unstacking their assorted gear strapped to a pallet on the aircraft's metal floor. The crew chief helped them carry the kit bags and Pelican cases to the tarmac, where a white F-250 had pulled up behind the Osprey. A small group of Peshmerga troops, armed with SCAR-17s and dressed in surplus U.S. desert camo and black body armor, stayed by the truck, while a tall, blonde-haired American wearing jeans and a tan polo shirt approached, looking like he'd just walked off the Norwegian ski team.
"Freddy, good to see you, buddy," the man said in recognition of Reese's partner.
"Hey, Eric, appreciate the pickup. Meet James Donovan."
"Donovan, huh? Okay, well, welcome to Kurdistan, James. Pleasure to meet you. I'm Eric Spur. I've heard good things."
Reese shook the man's extended hand.
"Good to meet you as well. Let's get you boys loaded up and out of here. Your guest is waiting."
Spur waved to the Kurdish troops, who moved quickly to help retrieve the men's gear and load it into the truck. Reese and Freddy insisted on helping. They both noticed that Eric left the work to the Kurds. They loaded into the crew cab pickup, Spur behind the wheel, and drove east through the city.
"What's that?"
Reese asked, turning in his seat to take in the huge fortress that occupied the high ground to his right.
"That's the famous Citadel of Erbil. They say it's been inhabited continuously since people first lived in this part of the world," Eric informed them.
"Good tactical position," Freddy observed. "Probably a good strategic one as well if it's been inhabited that long."
An hour east of Mosul, which had only